As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
After seven consecutive Ligue 1 titles in the early 2000s, we'd forgive you for thinking Lyon are still firmly a part of European football's aristocracy.
Juninho, unstoppable!
Qui s'enfonce, Benzema s'est retourné, la frappe de Benzema! Et le but! Formidable enchaînement! Karim Benzema!
But after 11 games this season, they're bottom of the table. Their world-famous pool of academy talent seems to have dried up. And after losing one of the most influential football executives of this century, could a genuine legacy club soon be a second division side? I'm Ayoakim Waleri. Welcome to the Athletic Football Podcast. Okay, so Lyon are up next. This is part four of the Athletic's Crisis Club series, examining the financial state of five European football clubs all week. So today I'm joined one last time by the Athletic senior football news reporter Matt Slater, and Adam Crafton is in the studio as well. We'll also hear from German football writer Raphael Hunningstein a little later on the show, on our fifth club, Hertha Berlin.
I mean, they've gone beyond being in crisis to just being perpetually terrible, really. The odd good spell disrupting the misery.
Right, let's start with Lyon. Adam, in short, if you can, why are Lyon on our list?
A difficult one to do in short, but that's why we have the podcast to try and to hopefully explain it. The headline is that they are, you know, one of the most famous clubs in France, and they are bottom of the league, which is a pretty difficult thing to achieve, really, for a club of the size of Lyon. You know, you may be used to a team starting four or five games slowly. You know, if you think of the best of Lyon, then you think of a side that won the league seven times in a row at the turn of the century, a club that has recruited really well, a club that has sold really well traditionally, a club that built a new stadium that opened in 2015-16, 59,000-seater stadium. Next year at that stadium, they'll be hosting Taylor Swift and they'll have Coldplay, and they've just had a few games at the Rugby World Cup and they'll have the Six Nations, and they'll be doing some football in the Paris Olympics in Lyon. So you've got all the ingredients there in theory for Lyon actually to be a really successful club, but they're not there at the moment. And there's a big background to all of this, which kind of merges probably so much of what you've spoken about this week already, which is the challenges of being a club that builds a new stadium and how paying for that has an influence down the line in terms of your ability to compete, particularly when you're competing with clubs that have been backed like Paris Saint-Germain or clubs that have been backed like Monaco with Russian investment over the past decade or so as well. You then bring into it a change of ownership or a change of control between what you would kind of consider the real old school of ownership, which is one guy, Mr. President, Jean-Michel Aulas, who was so, if you think of the most famous European football executives of the early part of the 21st century, this guy was amongst the main men, right? You had, was it the G, was it, I get mixed
G14.
Up. G14. G14, I get mixed up, G7, G12, G14. You had the G14, which was like one of the original exclusive groups of football executives, which he was at the top of. That was before you had like the European Club Association and things like that. Lyon were a club you'd always see in the Champions League. But the idea was you had this guy who'd taken over in 1986, 87, and he'd been there over 35 years. And he was Mr. Lyon. For better and worse, he was the owner. You knew what the focus was. You then have a takeover. That takeover, in theory, was actually quite a good idea. You had a US investor, John Textor, which was what we refer to as these multi-club models. So you had Lyon coming in under a group called Eagle Football Holdings, and he's got a stake in Crystal Palace, but it's not a majority stake. He's got majority control of Botafogo in Brazil. You've got Molenbeek in Belgium, who since he's taken over there, they've been promoted. Botafogo have been in a title race in Brazil. And if you've not paid attention to that race, it's worth tuning in because it's one of the most amazing title races you'll see. And he went into Lyon, and the idea was that it builds out that portfolio. So I suppose in his ideal, you'd have at the top of this tree Crystal Palace and Lyon, potentially as an English club and a French club that can trade players of real high value, players that, you know, you can move around for big money. And then you can develop talent in Brazil and move them into the European market. They can get those difficult work permits in Belgium, perhaps, if you're bringing them from Brazil that are far more difficult post-Brexit. I'm aware this is a really long answer, so cut in.
I'm just waiting.
At any point you want.
And go, do you know what? Can we sub this down?
Yeah. So the idea is all of those different clubs could dovetail nicely. It could help Molenbeek because they could get a player when they're still attainable, and then they could sell them on for big value. You could move them from Belgium to Lyon to help grow that value before they then get a move to the Premier League. So those were some of the synergies that were aimed at. And actually, the initial idea was Jean-Michel Aulas, as this guy who has been there for a very, very long time, would actually stay. He was basically on a management contract for a few years and effectively carry on running the club. The problem's been the new guy and the old guy have fallen out pretty spectacularly. So that's probably a good point for you to jump in with any questions we've got so far. but you asked how we got there, and that's... And that's before we even get into COVID and French media rights.
Where I usually bring Matt in, the COVID question, you know. Oh, yeah. I mean, how has COVID affected Lyon in particular? And I guess let's have a little roundup of how it affected the French league in general.
I think it is quite interesting to compare them to the clubs that have come before. And as Adam has explained, they tick a lot of the right boxes. They shouldn't be here. So if you compare them, let's say, to Everton, Barca and Inter, all those clubs have stadium projects ongoing. Lyon did it. They've had success. Okay, look, sport is cyclical, as we've already discussed in the series, and they're in a down moment. They get a lot right in terms of player development. They've got a fantastic women's team. They even did the things that we've all talked about again on this podcast, thinking about footfall and sweating your asset and getting people through the door. And, you know, so you don't just use your stadium 25 times a year, you use it every day. So they built an arena, right, to bring more events, more sport. So they've done loads right. So why are they on the list? They were stretched. The stadium stretched them. They probably were stretched on the playing budget as well. And then these two big external shocks happen. It's always the external shock, and it's all, and what sort of state were you in as you went into this shock? You know, what was your plan B? What was your plan C? This is really something that we can say about all French football. COVID was bad. They shut down. They didn't restart. They paid a big, you know, relatively speaking, they paid a big broadcaster rebate. And then they were in a hurry to start a new broadcast contract. And I think this is something that really hurt Lyon.
You're listening to the Athletic Football Podcast with Ayo Akinwolere.
So this is where we get into this whole, again, this is something we've briefly touched upon, you know, the value of rights and, you know, everyone's trying to compete with the Premier League. The French TV deal did this massive blockbuster deal with a company called MediaPro, a completely untried and tested company outside of Spain, where they have a track record. And they have customers, and people knew who they were, and they knew what they were doing. MediaPro, stuff full of Chinese money, which reminds everybody of the inter-conversation we were having, the Chinese football boom. So it all ties together. MediaPro, we're going to try and expand into other markets. And France was the one they really went for. And I remember they had this big push to get to €1 billion per season. And they went with MediaPro, which meant turning their backs on their long-term partner, the Sky Sports, if you like, of French media landscape, Canal Plus. Long story short, it was a disaster. The whole thing unraveled in the most ludicrous fashion within months. And it meant that French TV, all these French clubs, and Lyon had pushed the deal, by the way, were left with half the money they thought they were getting through the door during COVID.
So whereas the English league paused and then restarted and finished the season, what happened in France was that I think basically the government said, you're not coming back. And Lyon were very unhappy about this. And why were they unhappy about this? Well, mostly because they were seventh in the table. And they probably thought, you know, maybe 7 or 8 to 10 games left. We haven't not been in Europe since 1997 at that point. We'll find a way to get in because that's, you know, that's how it tends to work. The big clubs tend to get there in the end by hook or by crook. So it stopped and the points per game formula had them finishing seventh. So it meant they were outside Europe for the first time in over 20 years. And since then, actually, in the three full seasons, I think, since they've been out of Europe for two of those 3 years. Now, you can get away with it once, maybe twice. Once it becomes 3 years, when you don't have that brilliant broadcast deal domestically or internationally anymore, you're in trouble because then you're really just left with matchday revenue.
It's your third budgetary shock then, isn't it? It's COVID. It was the TV deal being not as good as we thought it was going to be. And we've missed Europe, something that we have always budgeted for.
Yeah. And the fourth one is the only other way you can smart your way out of that is by being amazing on player trading.
Yeah.
And that's something Lyon had been really good at, right? Even if you look at, I think between 2015 and 22, only four clubs in Europe made more money from players they had trained through their academy than Lyon. You can go through a list of famous names that have come through Lyon, players like Lacazette, Umtiti, Hatem Ben Arfa, Anthony Martial, a lot of players.
Benzema.
And as a result of that, they'd been able to not only succeed for quite a long time, but quite often by making money as well. I mean, even in the past 3 years, I think they've brought in 200 million more or so than they've actually spent in the transfer market. Now, that's not a problem as long as you're doing well. I think now fans are looking at that and thinking, should we be spending a bit more of what we're bringing in?
They're going to have to.
Yeah. And also what they did start to let slip on was a bit like Daniel Levy had always been being described as this tough negotiator, this guy that always gets a good deal when he's selling. I think that was the perception in France of Jean-Michel Aulas. And what you had start to happen were a few misjudgments.
Back across, bitten out by the goalkeeper. And Houssem Aouar equalises for Lyon.
A player like, do you remember Houssem Aouar? I think I pronounced that right.
I think supposed to be going to Arsenal, or there were links
midfielder,
anyway, to
yeah, linked to Arsenal, Spurs. I remember writing transfer stories about interest in him. You were talking 50 million or so at the time. He ended up leaving on a free because Lyon really dug in. They thought that he would continue to progress at Lyon. And actually what happened was changes of managers. He went out of favour. All of a sudden, he didn't want to extend a contract. He ends up leaving for free. It can happen. But when your margins are so tight and relying on that revenue, it becomes a problem. And it wasn't only him. You had Memphis Depay, a little bit similar situation. You had Moussa Dembele, who's now at Etifak, who could have gone for decent money at that time. Even though in that period, they still did some really good deals. Bruno Guimaraes, who ended up at Newcastle, 40-odd million. Lucas Paquetá signed for about 5 million from Milan and ends up going to West Ham for 40-odd million, even more, I think, 50 million. And I think there probably would have been a sell-on if he'd gone to City in the summer, which would have helped. So it's not as simple as, like, you know, they've messed up everything, because they've not. They've been unlucky in some senses. There's been different circumstances. And then the other problem they had last summer, which maybe explains how they've started this season, and this isn't only the fact that you still had pretty outdated coach in Laurent Blanc starting the season, they were also restricted in what they were able to do in the transfer market by... Essentially, it's the French DNCG, which is like the financial watchdog, which you have to submit to, I think, every kind of Christmas and before the summer, ahead of the January summer transfer windows. so that you have an idea of what you're going to be allowed to spend. And the idea of it is really good. The idea is it protects clubs from doing a Portsmouth, from overspending, from going beyond their means. It's probably edging towards overregulation relative to what we see in the English game, I would say. But it's there to protect clubs. And they took issue with the financial plans that were being presented by Lyon last year, which meant that last summer, Lyon weren't able to spend very much. So they ended up doing 3 transfers, loans, and some pretty weak deals.
Yeah, and this DNCG, it's a nice little halfway house, really, between what we were talking about with Barcelona on Tuesday in terms of their long-running battle with La Liga's very tough and bespoke budget system, where each club is basically handed a budget based on, you know, you've got too much debt, what are you bringing through the door? I think the French system isn't as strict as that, but it's equally more strict than the very laissez-faire approach that we were talking about on Monday with Everton, where it's always retrospective. Again, with this change of control from, you know, Monsieur President, someone who sat on French committees for ages and ages, everybody knew him, to this, you know, slightly upstart American fella walking through the door. The previous set of American owners in the French league hadn't gone particularly well. And Textor, rightly or wrongly, feels that he's being held to a higher standard than most.
First of all, you seem like a very nice woman, but that is honestly I know you have to ask the question. It's a comical question. This team is not at risk of relegation. Teams that get relegated in any country.
There's a little bit of anti-Americanism there. I'm not sure. There certainly probably is a little bit of anti-John Textor going on here, because he can be a tiny bit brash. And has he managed that relationship with Olas very well? No, he hasn't. Is it all his fault? No. Is there a case here of seller's remorse? 100%. Did Textor pay maybe a little bit too much? Yeah, probably. So, you know, there's a sort of personal element to this story. And then there is this sort of institutional angle as well, with, you know, how French clubs have to interact with their financial fair play regulator.
The Olas thing is fascinating, because it is old meets new, and it was a good idea, right? Like, you get a new guy in, but you let the old guy kind of carry on taking care of things. Like, I think they both meant well to a certain extent, but it's a bit like someone buying a house but letting you carry on living in the spare room, and then getting really offended when you start changing the furniture around. And that's where I don't have that much sympathy, to be honest. It got pretty nasty in the summer. Nasty, just a bit shambolic, really. I think
he's done personally well out of this. Let's not forget.
Yeah, right. And I think supporters in the summer, so there was a press conference, I think, that Textor kind of suggested that there'd been a previous warning from the DNCG to Lyon, and that he didn't know about this when he acquired the club. You then had Textor through his group coming out and saying, you know, if he's saying that, it's not true. And then there's a defamation case. And that's messy. I mean, this guy, Aulas, he's not disappeared. He's still got a president's box. Mm-hmm. He's still going to games. And it's a bit like when Wenger left Arsenal, right? As soon as a legend like this leaves, the memory of them becomes pretty good, right? Because you start thinking of, oh, look at everything they did for Lyon. Took over when they were second division, indebted. We were winning leagues with him. Now we're bottom of the league. And actually, the reality is a bit like late Wenger, late Aulas wasn't very good, which probably helps the new head coach, Fabio Grosso, who's come in, because I think the fans now are almost thinking he's got it tough. You know, dealing with these two people going at each other all the time in public, he needs to keep us up, so we as a fan base are going to get behind him. And just one point on the fan base, I mean, you don't mess around with the ultras in Lyon lightly. I think they lost against PSG 4-1 early in the season, after which Laurent Blanc was sacked. One of the fans got a megaphone, and you have this extraordinary video, go and find it online, where one of the ultras is basically just telling the players to pull their socks up and saying they're not putting the shift in, saying, you know, other players have glorified this shirt, you're going to be smearing it or tarnishing it. I mean, it's amazing theatre to watch, but it's also, I can't imagine going out at Lyon as a player right now for a home game and feeling particularly comfortable around it.
I really appreciate you wrapping that up very quickly, Adam. Really appreciate that. But real talk, the question is, how do they get out of this mess? They're sitting bottom of, you know, Ligue 1, no European football. And also, you mentioned it earlier, the academy. I mean, is there a way out? I know they sold Bradley Barcola to PSG very recently, and the president naturally was not happy. That was key Lyon talent. But are there any pickings from the talent, the youngsters that they can rely on or maybe build on for the future?
Yeah, I think one of the problems they've got is they're running out of players to sell. I think what will help is, because they sold a couple of players in the summer, and you also got Malo Gusto went to Chelsea for 30-odd million. I think the feeling is they're selling players quicker than they would have done previously. I think that's one of the concerns, because they've kind of had to balance the books being out of European competition. Mm-hmm. Because of who they sold in the summer, they should be able to have a better deal with the DNCG for January. And I think Texter's intention is to invest. I think he recognises that he probably got it wrong in terms of the timing around keeping Laurent Blanc as long as he did, in terms of overestimating perhaps how good this squad is. More broadly, you know, one of the things Matt mentioned, which I should have mentioned at the top as well, is, I mean, Lyon's women's team has been a jewel in the crown in many sense. When Lyon's men's team stopped winning, you had this women's team that was, again, another example of Lyon doing things right.
Yeah, being forward-thinking.
Being forward-thinking, yeah. Getting on that curve, winning a load of Champions Leagues. And even in, you know, that's not gone away. I think they won 2022 mm-hmm. as well, right? But what is happening now, because there is, I think, around 450 million or so worth of debt. And the way around that appears to be selling the arena that Matt mentioned. So you've got this arena that they built, a multi-purpose sports and entertainment by the stadium. So they're going to sell that, which will help. Selling, doing a joint venture with the women's team, with a US investor called Michelle Kang. That's a great name, isn't
it? Yes, Michelle Kang.
Michelle Kang, who is also involved with the Washington Spirit in the NWSL in the States. So as a result of that, Lyon are also going to have to sell OL Reign, which they acquired a few years ago, because you can't have two teams in the same league in the States. So they're going to raise a bit of money that way. And then there's also a bond issue, if you want to explain that.
Yeah, well, look, so as they're selling assets, right? So again, we're going back to the Barcelona conversation, aren't we? How do you get out of it? You have to sell stuff. So they're selling stuff. But I think some of the criticism of Texter is that it looks like a fire sale. What he will say is that, no, this is all planned and strategic. And there is some truth in that he was talking about this stuff right from the outset. So the Lyon women's team story is interesting. He genuinely sees this as a good, clever, positive thing to do. It's going to be a joint venture with this business partner called Michelle Kang, who is a real champion of women's soccer in the States. So that was planned. Now, the timing and the perception, though, is the problem. It does look like he is flogging something that used to be good at Lyon. The OL Reign team, they're based in Seattle. That's you could argue, is a sort of sensible move. It was a non-core, probably a bit of a distraction. If they can get a good price for it, because now's a good time to sell, you know, women's soccer franchises in the States, great. They're actually using the same bank, Reign, that sold Chelsea and trying to sell Manchester United. So, you know, again, there are parallels with other things we've talked about. I think the arena is probably a slightly more interesting one, and probably is a bit more of right, we've got a bigger hole to fill here than I thought. In that arena, I do remember when it was built, and I remember, you know, a couple of consultants telling me that I think they'd actually worked on the projects. That's exactly the type of thing that all forward thinking football clubs should be doing. You know, really kind of like trying to sort of create a kind of walled garden around your club, trying to get people involved, trying to keep them there longer. Well, they're selling it. And I think what Texter would say is, look, we're having a look at the forward projections. We think it will bring this much in over the next 25 years. I think we can sell it now for pretty much the same amount and hand it over to someone else. It's all good. Who knows, right? We're not looking at the books. He tells people it's a good deal. We shall see.
I think the controversy with that is, where does that money from the arena go? I know there's been some reporting, I think, on Bloomberg Financial Times saying some of it may go into the Eagle Football Group, this multi-club funding sort of academies around. There's one in Africa, one in the States.
I think it will. He wants. So again, this is that kind of clash of personality, but also clash of strategy. You know, Leon have gone from being the apple of someone's eye, the most important thing in a man's world, and they are now an important thing in a group's world. But where they sit in that group's pecking order isn't clear. And this is where I often come back to any conversation about a multi-club is you have to be totally clear about what you're trying to do. So the ones that appear to work quite well are ones that have clearly defined strategies and clearly defined pecking orders. So if you think about Red Bull, right? So Red Bull, you've got these two teams, Leipzig and Salzburg. Leipzig's probably the more important one because they're in the bigger league, but Salzburg is the sort of one that's probably closest to Red Bull's heart. But let's be honest, the most important thing in that group is Red Bull, the energy drink. It is all about selling energy drinks, the way they play football, their whole messaging, you know, and everyone is working to that end. The football kind of works quite nicely. City Football Group, totally obvious and clear who's in charge. It works. But you look at Eagle Football Group, and there's a couple others, you know, 777, of course, where I'm not sure what the plan is. You know, they talk a really good game about synergies and cutting costs and sharing best practice and creating a kind of player trading model. Yeah, it's great. It's like a sort of, you know, a PhD thesis. It's brilliant. Go on then, prove it. Because otherwise it looks like you've just running, instead of running one club, which is really, really hard and not maybe doing very well at it, you're running 5, 6, 7, 8 clubs and not doing very well at it. And you are just compounding problems. So that's, you know, the theory that, you know, the jury's very much out on Eagle Football, and Leon is sort of sitting in the middle of this experiment in the same way that Everton may well sit in the middle of an experiment. And that's, again, an uneasiness about Leon's situation. But also, dare I say, you have to be honest, a possible way out. So to turn it around, these asset sales could get them out. They're going to refinance debt. That's great. That's sensible. And, you know, this multi-club model might just work. We shall see.
It did help them in the summer. I mean, the one thing Leon fans may have seen as a positive in the summer, when you had these limits on the transfer market, something they were able to do, which some people will look at and think it's pretty controversial. Other people will say it was pretty clever in the circumstances. Molenbeek, Belgian team, just being promoted from the second Belgian division, buy a player for €25 million from FC Nordjylland, Ernest Nuemar, sort of 20-year-old wide player. He goes to Molenbeek and immediately goes on loan to Leon, right? So it was a player that Leon wanted, but they couldn't afford to buy him because of the restrictions. So you get him into a different club within Eagle and then immediately get him on loan. A lot of clubs looked at that and were like, shit, we need to change the rules, right? Because this is a way, they would say, of getting around financial restrictions and having an advantage that we don't have unless we're in a multi-club model. The flip side of that is we are getting towards a stage where pretty much every club in France or Belgium is part of a multi-club model. So maybe it kind of just works.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Well, Rafa, I mean, look, we're talking about clubs in crisis, or crisis clubs, I should say. We need a German perspective on this. Hertha Berlin. I mean, reading a piece you dropped very recently, I mean, this is a really fascinating club. High drama, not in the Bundesliga anymore. How has it all unfolded for Hertha Berlin?
I don't know where to start. I mean, they've gone beyond being in crisis to just being perpetually terrible, really. The odd good spell disrupting the misery rather than the other way around. The problem I think that they've had historically is that they were on this island, West Berlin, in the middle of the GDR, and it wasn't a very particularly wealthy area, Berlin, up until reunification. So financially, they struggled throughout the post-war years, and they were relegated, and they were involved in some bribery scandals. And then they had a golden period towards the turn of the century. And then they were relegated again twice. And then they had this big idea in the tens after 2013 to become this startup club, to transform the image from being a pretty less than mediocre and always prone to scandals, kind of nothingness, to being sexy and cool like Berlin, the city. And the problem was that they took some external money on for that. And it worked for a time. But as often is the case with these startups, you run out of money eventually. And that's where they are at the moment. There's some new money coming in. But whether that will change their fortunes, I'm extremely doubtful.
I think what was interesting about looking down the line of things was the amount of managers that have come in and out of Hertha Berlin. I mean, you talk about instability. Jürgen Klinsmann, I mean, how long did he last for?
76 days. Wow. I mean, they would have liked to keep him a bit longer, but he decided he wanted to leave. And he left from one moment to the next, leaving them completely in the ditch with relegation fight being on the cards. And since then, there's been more and more changes, and sporting directors have come and gone, presidents have come and gone, financial officers have come and gone. It's a completely different Hertha now than it was only 1.5 years ago. But whether these new people are necessarily better placed to right the wrongs of the past and to take Hertha forward, I'm not so sure. They've tried to completely once again reinvent themselves and saying, you know, enough of these delusions of grandeur, enough of this trying to become a super club, let's go and do sort of a Hertha thing, having former players involved, looking at youth football, looking to promote within, looking to live within our means. And it's all a very noble undertaking, but it's yet to deliver results, because it looks as if they won't be going up next year, and another season in Bundesliga 2 is just going to make their finances even worse.
Mm. One of the things we found in correlation with our clubs in crisis is that COVID massively was a really interesting time for football, you know, across Europe. What was the Germans' perspective on this? How did COVID affect already dwindling team?
Yeah, COVID was a massive hit for all the Bundesliga clubs, because they don't tend to have external money that they can call upon to tidy them over, which was why we saw huge pressure for the league to restart. And they were the first major league to restart worldwide in May of 2020. With Hertha, it was a real double whammy, because they had just taken on some debt to buy back some shares that they had sold to KKR, a US private equity group. So in order to get more money in, they wanted to buy back their shares and then sell the shares again to another investor, which they did. Lars Windhorst, London-based financier, coming in. The problem is that they took on debt to make that happen. So the new money that came in that was supposed to really kickstart them, a lot of it was squandered on players that didn't have success. And then a lot of it was used to service the debt that they amassed through buying back the shares and making up for the losses, huge losses during COVID. What was supposed to be this transformative investment amounted to very little and didn't really change the equation. And if anything, down the line, made it harder for them to recover financially.
What have 777 Partners got to do with all of this? Because, you know, we know they're trying to buy Everton, which we covered on Monday.
Yeah, so 777 took over the shares from Lars Windhorst to become majority owners in the club subsidiary, the way that things are organized in Germany is that you cannot directly invest into the club, but you can invest into the football company that is owned by the club ultimately. Yeah, we're yet to see whether that's going to have a positive effect, because most of the money that they've put in has, of course, gone to the former owner of the shares. It's not money that directly comes into the club. They've promised to invest money into the club as well to help with some of the debt, to help with this course of cost saving that they've embarked upon. And they have made some progress. You know, a team that cost 80 million euros to run, just in terms of wages and transfer fees, amortization fees last year, is only down to 30 now. They will still lose a lot of money. Their own predictions suggest that they will lose up to 64 million euros this year, as they have to grapple with reduced income from being in Bundesliga 2. You know, TV rights are not comparable. The parachute payments that we see in the Premier League, we don't really have them to the same extent in the Bundesliga. So the fall is much steeper, and they have to recover from that while at the same time trying to build a team that can take them back up again.
I can't help but think, very different situations, but Union Berlin are sitting at the bottom of the Bundesliga at this moment in time. What is it with Berlin clubs and coming up and down of the Bundesliga? Come on, what's going on? This is a cool city. This is where the hipsters are. You need a club that can really show the pizzazz that Berlin has to offer.
I mean, Union's troubles are harder to explain because they've been the exact opposite of Hertha since going up 5 years ago. They've been super successful in Europe 3 times, even in the Champions League this season. But of course, the results have been very poor. They got rid of their manager, Urs Fischer, and it's looking quite grim at the moment. But a lot of people expect that to be a blip because they are extremely well run, unlike Hertha. They are embarking on a modernization project for the stadium. The team is pretty decent. We just have to hope that with new management coming in, at the moment they have a caretaker manager who I don't think is going to last that long, they will find that winning formula again. Otherwise, they'll be joining Hertha next year in Bundesliga 2, which will bring back the derby. But that's probably not what both clubs want at this point.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
You're listening to the Athletic Football Podcast with Ayo Akinwolere.
This multi-club ownership, and you know, we've just seen on Tuesday news that Premier League clubs have voted to block a temporary ban on loaning players. Is this the future? Is there any regulation that can take place, or have UEFA missed the boat on this? Matt, we'll start with you on this.
Well, it's the present. You know, it's just exploded as a concept. Have UEFA missed the boat? Possibly. You know, they are trying hard. I think they're scrambling, really, to sort of kind of fix problems as they pop up, when they possibly, you know, it's all we can all be really wise in hindsight, can't we? But if you go back to that kind of original Red Bull case, or even before that, when the first rules on multi-club, if you like, though people weren't referring to it in those terms back then, was Enic. When that was, you know, the people that ended up at Tottenham, you know, they had stakes in various clubs across Europe, and that was the first time UEFA started to think about it in terms of competitive integrity. So, you know, what happens if the same owner has various clubs in the same competition? You know, I think we can all get our heads around that is a potential integrity issue. So that's where we had this idea of control. You know, you can't have control over more than one club in the same competition. And, you know, the next big case was Red Bull, where both Leipzig and Salzburg were eventually allowed to play in Europe. And it required this most ludicrous piece of accountancy and governance footwork to sort of distance the two clubs, you know, RB Leipzig, Red Bull Salzburg, and separation and making sure that there weren't people that had worked for each other. Honestly, it was all a bit of a fudge. And that's where we're at. You know, and now, as more multi-club groups have popped up with, let's say, a clearer idea around player trading, we're now seeing the leagues, but also UEFA going, well, this is really tricky now. You're posing me problems that I hadn't thought of. I just thought about the integrity of my competitions. I'm now trying to think how on earth I apply financial fair play rules when you could be sharing sponsors, you can be sharing players, you can be, loaning players to each other. You can be, you know, how on earth do I do this? You know, I have to benchmark so many more things now to get a fair market value than I ever assumed. I'm saying I'm sort of personalizing these organizations. And I think it is posing issues that no one predicted.
It's also posing issues because some of these people are being pretty clever, right? Is Newcastle a multi-club model or not? Like, okay, the owners of Newcastle have invested in these four teams in Saudi. Do they consider themselves a multi-club model in the same way as a Red Bull or a Eagle? Not really. Even, you know, who's top of the Spanish league at the moment? Girona,
right? Yeah.
I think that's a 44% stake that Man City, that CFG have. That isn't, I suppose, the majority control, right?
No, but it would be more. Again, we're kind of learning by precedent. So we had a whole spate of this in the summer where Aston Villa and I can't remember the name of their club. Which one have they got a connection with in Portugal? It'll come back to me later. But Union Saint-Gilloise and Brighton, and there was another link. There were three linked clubs that were going into UEFA competition. And they all had to either dilute their shareholding. So Villa's owners diluted down in the Portuguese club to about 30%. That appears to be sort of the level where UEFA are comfortable. But also get into an agreement, a kind of almost a promise, that we won't trade players for a year or two.
Yeah. Which is going to be, you know, if you look at Manchester United, who are about to do this deal with Jim Ratcliffe, who clearly has, Ineos have majority control of Nice, you're going to have a very odd situation where you have a minority stake, but sporting control. And it's going to be fascinating to see how that is worded in the official, because all we're going off at the moment are briefings and reports and speculation. How that is worded in the agreement that will be announced at some point over the next few years / decades is going to be fascinating, because it, you know, there's how many times have you read over the last 6 months Man United want to sign their Nice defender Todibo, right? How does that work? United didn't try and block those kind of loans in that Premier League meeting this week. So I don't know if that's an indication, or they may just not have thought about it that much yet. I'm sure there would have been a conversation somewhere. So even if you don't have control, or even if you don't have 30%, some of this can start to become really interesting. I think PSG and Braga is that's similar kind of stake now, right? But they've been in European competition. So this is kind of on everyone's doorstep. And even those clubs that aren't currently, I suppose, embroiled in it, they'll have an eye on their potential exit strategies, right? And not closing down potential new owners down the line who may be really keen on multi-club models. And therefore, you don't want to bring stuff in that deters people from investing. A bit like you'll never get a rule that blocks state-linked funds, right, from being involved in Premier League clubs being voted in by Premier League owners, because that might be their way out for a West Ham or a Spurs or whatever in a few years. Who knows? So those are the things, those are some of the complications and challenging things that we always, I think, media and football fans think, just deal with it. And actually, when you get into it, there's just another issue that emerges every time you unpick it.
But just sort of bringing it back to Lyon and France, you're absolutely right. Pretty much every single club, I'd argue, apart from PSG, is sort of for sale. And it's kind of for sale. They will be for sale because they're very much the fifth of the five big leagues. If they're not careful, they're going to get replaced by someone like Portugal or maybe a merged Belgian Dutch league. So they're there, and their TV rights aren't that popular. There's just not much interest in them abroad. It's a shame, because actually, if you watch the products, it's pretty good. It's got this kind of reputation for being a very young league, playing nice attacking football. But for whatever reason, it has struggled to get people outside of France, and I would dare I say enough people in France to really care enough to pay for it. There is a sort of existential issue there for France, and therefore Lyon, because Lyon aren't PSG. They need the French league to do well, to have any kind of chance of, you know, getting back to where they were when they were winning French titles.
That they also, I think at the moment, you have both the domestic and international rights are up for tender, and they are struggling. Yeah. They are really struggling. I think there was some vague hope that you'd get someone like Apple come along and take all the rights, a bit like they have with MLS globally. I don't think that's going to happen. They've kind of been bailed out by beIN for quite a long time, and they may do it again in the end. Who knows, right? But I think the priority, you know, in the lead up maybe to 22, that was all maybe a bit more of a priority to make sure we're looking after this league and still protecting it. I think now they're probably getting to the point where they get a load of grief quite a lot of the time, and I'm not sure they're as mad on it. And if they are going to do it, I think they won't probably pay quite what clubs want them to. So it does, and then you're going back to like begging Canal Plus, right, to come back to the table.
Are you upset that you've told
to leave?
Yeah.
All right, let's bring this back full circle then. I'm just trying to figure out or get a sense of what we've really learned from these conversations about our crisis clubs. Matt, especially with COVID, and I keep coming back to it, I guess a lot of clubs struggled with COVID, but actually clubs that weren't run well struggled more. And it was glaringly obvious when something like COVID hit that there are a lot of clubs out there that really need to get their books in order.
I think that's it. It's that black swan moment. And are you ready? Mm-hmm. You know, we're having an inquiry about it in this country, aren't we? How ready were we? And the countries that sort of got through it better were the ones that had a plan, that also, you know, were just in better shape. They entered the crisis in bad shape. They were stretched. I'd argue there was a bit of bad luck for some of them. Never underestimate the impact of luck in life, but certainly in business and sport. So I think that's that. It's this crisis came along, hurt all of them in different ways for different reasons, be it, you know, they had an amazing museum, or they were trying to build a stadium, or, you know, they relied on Chinese money or whatever it is. But they were not in great shape when this crisis happened. Simple as that.
Then it brings me the question, and we were thinking about this earlier, is that, I mean, I feel a lot of clubs are just running really close to the edge, whichever way you look at it. Which clubs, or the bigger clubs in Europe, I should say, would you think are the best run clubs in Europe, most sustainably run clubs in Europe?
Just depends how you define well run, right? Like, are Man City going to go out of business? Well, not as long as the current ownership's in place, right? Like, and you know, but at the same time, they're facing 115 charges, right? Mm. Is that a well-run club? Mm. Arguably.
They're very well-run now.
Right.
And also, you know, and how important is success on the field? Because this is sport, right? You know, we're not talking about supermarkets, or, you know, we are talking about sport. So winning, presumably, is part of your, you know, how you assess this. So,
and even if you talk about, you know, we all talk about Brighton, right? Brilliantly run club. They've relied on a huge amount of owner investment, right? Mm. They may get to, you know, they'll get to a stage where they're sustainable as a club in the Premier League. is that a well-run business? You'd say, yeah, really, but also hugely reliant on external factors to make sure it can happen. I don't think there is, you know, if we were asked to sit down as a, you know, one of the big four consultants tomorrow to say, this is how you run a football club and this is the perfect model.
There's never one way.
It doesn't
way.
Exist.
There's never right? one way. Look, I was just sort of, whilst Adam was talking there, I mean, I would probably throw maybe Real Madrid into the mix, again, because of that whole conversation we had around Barcelona. So many of the things that Barcelona got wrong, Real Madrid have got, if not right, they've got it considerably less wrong than Barca. And I think, you know, this is hard. No one's ever suggesting this is easy. So I would possibly suggest Real would be an example of a well-run club.
Liverpool?
You know, they get plenty wrong. A Liverpool would be another one. You know, on-field success, a sustainable business. The fabric of that club is clearly improved under that ownership. Their sort of status in the global game has clearly improved under that ownership. So I think, you know, Liverpool would have to be in the mix. I think Man City, definitely a debate to be had, because you cannot dispute the way that club is run right now in terms of on-field success, in terms of what they do commercially, in terms of recruitment, youth development. But there's a massive but that I don't need to get into, because we'll be, you know, three hours.
Don't get Crafton started
another week on Man City. I'm trying to think, who else? Bayern Munich.
Serie A winners, you could say kind of the model of German football helps them.
It does.
Substantially. Doesn't mean that they're doing things wrong, though. You know, when this is what I mean. It's so, you can pick one and you can find a fault. But in terms of who's doing more right than wrong, both on the pitch and off the pitch, then yeah, you know. Equally, I'd say if Man United had been in Bayern Munich's position for the last 15 years, you know, there's been years where Bayern Munich have made quite a few mistakes, but they still win the league.
Yeah.
Right? Last season, they were pretty poor by their...
Yeah, they tried not to win last year.
Right, they did their best.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, they sacked the chairman, didn't they? Basically, the day they won the league. But because of the way German football is with the disparities, kind of means they can get away with it to a broader extent. Sorry to Bayern Munich fans who I know are loyal listeners.
I still think they're a pretty well-run club.
I agree.
Okay, so let's end on this. Hypothetically, if The Athletic gave both of you $1 billion to invest in our crisis clubs, I'm talking Hertha Berlin, Inter Milan, Barcelona, Everton, Lyon, which one are you picking? Adam.
I don't know if a billion's enough for Barcelona to deal with all the problems.
Well, it's not.
It's not, is it?
But it would certainly
be a start.
It would have an impact. Yeah, yeah.
I think you take Barcelona, don't you? Imagine running Barcelona, but you can't because of the bloody fans.
You could be president. You could run a nice campaign.
Yeah, you could run a campaign.
Yeah. Some personal guarantees.
I think Everton for a billion. If you've got a billion in your pocket, it'd be pretty good stuff.
Yeah, if it's to buy total control of one. Yeah. I was just wondering, because we haven't really talked that much about Hertha, but you know, but you could do, you know, Hertha of the five, right? They're the sort of slightly unusual one in that they don't really belong here in many ways in terms of like their track record. I was just looking at it. You know, they were a great club in the 20s and 30s, but the rest of their story is, you know, just being sort of a bit of a calamity and being a bit of, oh, you know, at times a bit of a laughing stock. And yet they are the biggest club in a major European city, a cool European city, in the capital of Europe's largest economy. So, I don't know. Do I throw a billion at Hertha and try and turn Hertha into one of Europe's giants? Maybe.
Bring the hipster back to Hertha Berlin, is that what you're saying?
I was talking to a chief exec of a European club, actually, about this series a couple of weeks ago, and they were trying to guess which clubs would be on the list. And I think they basically got three of them pretty quickly.
Yeah.
I think Everton, Barcelona, Inter.
Yeah.
Inter.
Yeah.
The other one they mentioned was Schalke.
Yes.
Which is an amazing story. Yes. They are, just looking at the table, 16th in the second division of an 18-team league in Germany. I mean, that's a club that was in the Champions League.
And they have been good more recently.
Yeah.
You know, you know, Hertha have only had one season in the Champions League. So, you know, I don't think they are...
Still, you should read Raph's piece.
You definitely read. Yeah, he absolutely explains. You know how there's Berlin's biggest team are a shambles, and it's a long running shambles, and also really neatly ties in to so many of the other things we're talking about. You know, they're owned by 777, so therefore they're part of a multi club group. There's governance issues. There's overspending. They've got this big old stadium that badly needs, arguably knocking down, but certainly, revitalizing. So many of the other points that we touched upon are in the Herter story. But let's do this again. There's definitely other clubs we've left on the table.
There's room next international series. Sure. Look,
for any clubs who are offended by their description as a crisis club, because I'm sure they'll love that. They're welcome to come on this podcast and talk about it.
Explain why they're not.
Yeah. And explain why they're not. And if in 2 years' time they turn out to be very, very clever, we will also write about that. So
definitely. Back from the brink.
Back from the brink.
Yeah, that's the next series.
Just feeding us with bare material. All right. Thank you, Matt. Also, Adam, I really appreciate your time as well, contributing to the podcast this week. The entire Clubs in Crisis series is available to read in full only on The Athletic. You can, of course, catch up with all of this week's episodes wherever you get your podcast from. Also, we still have that very special Black Friday offer of just $1 or £1 a month for 12 months, running until Monday the 27th. So head to theathletic.com/footballpod. To get on that. Remember to rate and review us as well. Thank you all for listening. Adam Leventhal is back tomorrow to preview the return of the Premier League. Can't wait.
You've been listening to the Athletic Football Podcast. The producers were Adonis Pratsides and Guy Clark, with additional production by Mike Stavro and Jay Beale. The executive producer was AD Moorhead.
The Athletic.